I was sitting there, I just realized that I'm not feeling well. So I don't know if it was because of all of the extensive discussion of cheap food, or because of the dizzying, expansive work of Jason, and he certainly covered considerable ground in his, certainly in the book and in the talk today. So I'm grateful for him to be here and for the opportunity to engage with him in this context. So I had a number of things rushing through my head as he was talking, which made me want to divert my remarks, and I suspect that I will at some point here. But in one sense, I thought back to my dissertation. I couldn't remember the name of my dissertation, but I thought back to the dissertation. That's a beautiful thing when you forget the name of your dissertation. And in it, I was trying to struggle with the idea of the regulation of sugar workers, socio-legal regulation of sugar workers in 19th century Trinidad, as a way of grounding my work and my understanding. My activist work on the ground here with Justice for Migrant Workers, engaged with sort of the migrant farm workers who predominantly come through the seasonal agricultural worker program into Canada. Of course, I've been coming since 1966, originally from Jamaica, as we just heard, also from Mexico, among other places in the Eastern Caribbean. And that linkage, which nicely was picked up in Jason's talk, is one about historical continuity and what I would describe as the historical continuity of racialized capitalism. And certainly in that we see that unfreed labor plays a central and important role then and now. There's a historical continuity in that, to be sure. In another sense, I wanted to think about just the idea of cheap food, notwithstanding the fact that it's made my stomach upset, and the linking of food and labor and relations, and the understanding that food is a relation steeped within labor. And certainly in that, we would again think about labor and freedom. If the idea of cheap food is over, labor and freedom certainly is not. Right? Labor and freedom is not going anywhere. That's not any of that that I want to talk about today. I actually want to talk about law. I want to bring law into the conversation, or into the equation, as Jason said. Because if geography department was established first, then it would be the law department that gave it its authority. Law, in effect, asserts a pre-authority over everything, right? In the same way that we see the Royal Proclamation of 1763 asserting a pre-authority over the territory that we now call Canada. So in this sense, I want to talk about law as strategies of appropriation in settler colonial Canada in the contemporary moment. And with this, I actually want to think a little bit harder about what we mean by law and legality, or what I call social legality. I should say, though, that some of my work, as I've suggested, links back historically and also to contemporary migrant justice movements. I'm also working on, with Dana Scott, work on renewable energy as a new form of subsidy for growers in southern Ontario and elsewhere. And this is wrapped up in the context of settler colonialism and the intersections of the so-called food, energy, finance, and climate crises. And in this sense, in the renewable energy sense, in the discussions of so-called just transition, I can't help but think of this testimony that I read about a solar farm from a couple of local residents who said, "Harvesting the sun is a profitable cash crop with no labor and no maintenance." And certainly that ignoring of labor, work and labor, is central to the kind of work that I do, and it's central to the story I want to tell today. So So in my work then, I address the work and workings of Canada as a settler colonial capitalist entity with an emphasis on the role of law and legality. So my remarks follow from an engagement that I've written for a book that Mark Thomas and Leah Vosco, Carlo Finelli are editing on the political economy of law, or as I call it more properly, a critique of the political economy of socio-legality in the context of settler colonial capitalist Canada. So rather than talk specifically about Jason Moore's work, what I want to do is situate some of the issues he's raised within the larger thinking about law and socio-legality in contemporary Canada. The conventional point of departure for the study of law and legality in Canada remains an acceptance of the legitimate authority of the Canadian state and its law. Simply put, Canada is taken for granted. But what would it mean to trouble, destabilize, or downright unsettle this foundational assumption? After all, political and legal shifts, twists and turns notwithstanding, there's a great deal troubling about Canada as it pertains to its ongoing foundational relations with Indigenous peoples. And the troubles persist with respect to relations with so-called foreign, non-resident, and resident peoples. Given the stubborn persistence, Canada's taken-for-granted authority requires a great deal of work. The ongoing history of Canada's settler colonial capitalist authority has not just happened. Acting subjects have made and remade historical circumstances, even if not as they always please. It is this making and remaking the socio-spatial practices of ordinary people in everyday life that is the work and labor of those people that forms the focus of my intervention. My claim is that prevailing socio-legal perspectives in constructing socio-legality may appreciate that law constitutes the social and everyday life constitutes legality, but it fails to see this as work and labor. As a critique of the political economy of socio-legality, my intervention then is that socio-legality contains a material, productive, and reproductive dimension or core. I link this under-acknowledged facet of socio-legality, what I refer to as material legality, to the ongoing work and labor of settler colonial capitalism in the territory now known as Canada. In this, I show that the settler colonial studies itself displaces work and labor. So the work of Veracini, Wolfe, and many others. Colonialism has been understood as an expansionary process or form of domination of a group over native lands and labor. However, recent interventions, such as the work of Patrick Wolfe, enforce a sharp division or distinction between colonial and settler colonial formations. Famously characterizing settler colonialism as a structure, not an event, Wolfe's formative account takes settler colonial structure as, and I'm quoting here, not primarily established to extract surplus value from indigenous labor, but for displacing indigenous peoples from or replacing them on the land. In contrast to colonialism's dependence on native labor, settler colonialism is first and foremost a territorial project, quoting again, that prioritizes not extracting an economic surplus from mixing their labor with it, but displacement and replacement of natives on a given land. Territoriality on this account forms settler colonialism's specific irreducible element. Although not an event, settler colonialism is anything but uneventful. As a transformative structural relationship of domination and authority expressed in territorial terms, or through an emphasis on control or sovereignty over territory, it functions on an obfuscation of its necessarily violent means carried out to secure and enforce authority over a native or indigenous population. Of course, Jason has discussed this extensively. But carried out by whom? Veracini concedes that the metropolitan, colonial, settler-colonial distinctions remain purely analytical categorizations, which in reality intertwine and overlap in various ways in the context of shifting patterns of relations, end quote. That said, one must question the sorts of explanations that these analytical distinctions undermine. Here it appears, the emphasis on the settler-colonial relation negates any sustained interrogation of the colonial relation. A common approach within the settler-colonial studies is to provisionally delay or forestall the question of labor. Seminal efforts privilege land dispossession in the first instance, treating land as the principal resource, but then turn around and bring labor in through the back door. As Cole Harris notes, the initial ability to dispossess rested primarily on physical power and the supporting infrastructure of the state. Similarly, to the extent that settler colonialism is characterized as an expropriated land base, driven by settlers' interest in land as livelihood, expropriation and livelihood stand in for processes, practices, and ways of being or living more properly associated with conceptions of work and labor, chiefly social relations of production and reproduction. And of course, Jason quite rightly questions the use of the social and social reproduction in his work, and he offers some broader ways of thinking of that. And hopefully we can come back to that question and answer period. Hence, work and labor within the capital relation are distant frames in settler colonial accounts. A second point takes us back to law and legality. The socio-spatial practices of work and labor displaced within characterizations of unfolding settler colonial possession necessarily entail the work and labor of claiming and keeping, and these are legal constructs. For instance, agricultural work and labor has assumed a crucial place within settler colonial capitalist dispossession, especially the claiming and keeping of territory and land, and the resources that run with it. Christopher Tomlins, addressing the work of early English colonizers in peopling, planting, and keeping mainland North America, notes that, and I'm quoting here, labor was essential to colonizing because labor constructed the means of keeping. Labor transformed the face of the land. And as a legal notion, keeping is the process through which law would determine who kept what. Characteristic practices of planting and of agricultural work and labor more broadly proved integral to dispossession and appropriation in law and to the determination of who kept what. Or to put it differently, work and labor are necessary to the legal recognition and expression of settler state authority and private property ownership within settler colonial capitalist formations. But there's still more that can be added. Work and labor exist as a means of claiming and keeping, evident in the practices of early English, French, and other settlers who cleared the lands of North America, transforming it from waste into productive space, a transformation that in Lockean liberal terms justified private property ownership. Notwithstanding whether European settlers saw North America as empty or unpeopled, or as peopled by savages, for territoriality to work as the irreducible element of settler colonialism, there must be repeopling, there must be human practices of clearing, claiming, and keeping, a population from the metropole planted, an indigenous population supplanted. Planting and supplanting are processes of racialized valuation requiring hard work. The racialized dynamics of settler colonialism were imposed through pre-existing ideas and practices of difference. Of course, Jason again quite extensively covers this, but also derived meaning from the content of the activities, practices, and relations of settler colonial capitalism. In this latter respect, the work and labor of early settlers framed the racialized formation and formulation of social relations in the ever-expanding North American settlements. A pivotal dimension of the story is the undermining of the socio-spatial, that is, traditional practices and ontologies of indigenous peoples and introduced foreign populations, which occurred, of course, in racialized terms. The foundational colonization of indigenous peoples in traditional territory, consolidated and fortified through the system of reserve lands and reserve peoples, has been followed by other large-scale civilizing missions. The work and labor of settler colonialism in its early or initial deployments incorporates the socio-spatial practices of clearing, claiming, and keeping. And these practices continue through temporary agro-labor migration regimes, such as Canada's seasonal agricultural workers program, in which so-called foreign labor is produced as structurally necessary to horticultural production, and at the same time as outside invaders, both of these in service of capitalist accumulation. And a production that occurs in racialized ways through the devaluation of migrant laboring bodies and sending, receiving national state relations. And of course here Jason's pushing us, pushing me, to think about other natures as well. All of this work not only engages law, it forms the very content upon which law derives meaning, becomes lived existence, because ordinary people's lived existence informs law within settler colonial capitalist formations such as Canada. If the legal and social are co-constituted, one of the ways it occurs is through socio-spatial practices of belonging and living together undertaken by laboring bodies. So material legality then informs assertions of authority within the Canadian settler state. A key dimension of the work of settler colonialism is the work of displacement and replacement of indigenous peoples and territory to which those peoples toil, or toiled and toil, dwelled and dwell. Therefore, work, labor, and the capital relation matter to how we characterize settler colonialism and how we conceive of the sites, forms, and aims of resistance to prevailing structural relations and processes. The structures and struggles of settler colonial capital formations are constituted by work and labor practices and relations of subsistence or survival. This amounts to an intervention to restore work and labor to its rightful place, rightful in quotations, within settler colonialism. It is not meant as a reinscription of the economic and productivist, anti-social reproductivist, and whitewashed accounts of social life, but with a sense of the qualitative multiplicity of settler colonial capitalism's work and labor, informed by social reproduction and by an anti-racist and anti-work emancipatory practices. Thank you.
So many thanks, Lee.